Good morning. A Wendell Ashford update, and this will add about 30 minutes onto my presentation, so I hope you have time this morning. The most important update is I've upgraded from Wendell's black binder to the white binder now, so I suppose that's symbolic maybe of Wendell and I, but my apologies. He's not even paying attention. Anyhow, I do have just a few things I can share as by way of update. As you know, your own Josiah joined us on our most recent Justice Ride. The Justice Rides being a week-long mission trip where we train students to build a positive case for life and to expose the horror of abortion using victim imagery. It was our largest team yet on the road to Florida. Our bus was filled to capacity, and so that was a great update. But two more things I guess I could share, kind of showing where we're going as an organization, is a couple years ago we started putting a concerted effort on our local abortion facilities in Columbus and on our local abortionists, and we started the Killers Among Us project, exposing individual killers in our society, in our community. And because of that, last fall, two of the abortionists in Columbus folded. It was a father and son team with one business together, and they stopped their operations. So that was great. And of course, everyone clamors for credit saying we did that, and no one knows. It was a combined effort of many activists over a long time. But NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio said that it was due to efforts like ours of trying to pressure on them, I guess you could say. So that was their take on it. And also, really specifically what Create Equal's goal is, there are a lot of pro-life organizations. Our goal is specifically to train and equip preborn defenders who are part-time or also full-time. So because of that, a couple years ago, one of my biggest jobs was to create an internship where we could have students who are leaders come for a summer or a few months with us to see what it would be like to be a full-time worker in the pro-life movement. And at our first summer, 2 years ago, we had two interns. Last summer, we had five. And this summer, we have nine people coming. So that's a big move up for us. So that's an exciting update as well. So there's a brief update on where we are, where we're going, but truly, just on behalf of Aubrey and me, we are blessed to be here again. We have a lot of family and friends here, and we thank you for your support because you have given to us a lot of it. So from us to you, thank you, truly. Are we all created equal? How do you know? Today, when I'm asked these questions, my mind often drifts back to a hot summer day about 13 years ago. Now, summers can get toasty here in the Midwest, something we've almost entirely forgotten this frigid winter. However, they can. But on this July day when I was in high school, I was not in Indiana. I found myself in the sweltering heat of Kingston, Jamaica, along with other high schoolers from the Apostolic Christian Church, of which I was then a part. My dad and I had gone on a short-term mission trip to help work on a school for deaf children in Jamaica, a marginalized group in that society. But one day, I set aside my normal task of translating with sign language between my dad and a student who was really interested in welding as we all joined the rest of our team to go tour a Jamaican infirmary, an aging institution with chipped paint and overgrown weeds which belied the vitality of the people inside. And as we walked up, men, women, and children flooded a courtyard, men, women, and children with various physical and mental handicaps. And everywhere I turned, I saw them singing with, hugging, talking to my team members. And it was a really beautiful tableau of humans of different skin tones, different ages, different abilities, all coming together to share God's gift of human interactions. But then I turned, and I saw someone who did not look human. Now, the others in the courtyard varied from mild to severe handicaps, but they all looked like handicapped people I'd seen before. This girl was different. From top to bottom, she was no more than a foot and a half tall. She had no visible legs. I think she had one arm by which she dragged herself along the ground. And her face, honestly, I can't really remember it very well because in spite of all the contortions and disfigurements, I remember only one thing about her face, and that was her smile. I sat down with her, but then I realized that not only did she not look like me, but she couldn't do things I could do. She couldn't utter a single word. Later, we returned to work, and that interaction, brief as it was with that woman, whose status is sadly entirely unknown to me today, lingered in my mind, but not because I was somehow disgusted by her or bothered. On the contrary, I had been amazed by one critical truth, that what she looked like, what she acted like, had no bearing whatsoever on who she was, a human being made in God's image no less or no more than me. But that very simple idea, which I took for granted, is up for debate today. What if someone in Jamaica had looked at that young woman and said, well, she's not human? Well, we would respond to that scientific proposition with scientific evidence to the contrary to show that she is, in fact, a human being. But what if someone said, sure, she's human, but she's not equal to us, not to we, people? We may be shocked at that idea, but that is exactly the claim being made every day on college campuses and in downtown corners across the country about preborn human beings. Now, it is true there are those who are ignorant of the scientific evidence. They don't know that preborn babies are human. But there are other advocates of elective abortion who accept what is so very clear, that fetuses and embryos are humans, but instead they dispense with the idea that all humans are equal, regardless of their differences. So if we want to defend preborn babies, we must not only defend their nature, we have to also defend the idea of human equality itself. So my goal this morning is twofold: to provide a brief defense of human equality and demonstrate how we can respond to a couple of challenges to it. Now, the attacks we'll see are coming from both theological communities and those outside the church and the broader philosophical community. So I want to give brief attention to each this morning. First, I'll defend equality from biblical texts and philosophical thought. And second, we'll look at a couple of objections to it. But first, is there a case to be made for biblical equality, for equality from a biblical perspective? I think so. Now, I suppose we could spend a lot of time on this and look at a lot of texts, a lot of themes, but I'm just going to be brief with 3 points this morning. We have the plain sense of Genesis 1, 26, 27, suggesting all humans are made in God's image. Special protection is given to the category of human beings in God's word. And third, we also have God's care for socially marginalized people. First Genesis 1, a passage we're all very familiar with. Then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, etc., etc. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Now, if you read this passage and ask a question, who did God make in his image? The answer is pretty clear, I think. Mankind. The ESV footnote reads that the Hebrew word for man here is a generic term for mankind and becomes the proper noun Adam. Now, I think the natural reading of this text is that every entity who belongs to the category mankind bears God's image and is somehow set apart as a group from the rest of creation. There's something special about us. Second, we have God's words following the great flood, which demonstrate that not only is man set apart, but he's given initial special protection. We have this: whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. So God condemns shedding the blood of innocent beings who belong to the category of man. Why? Because they bear his image. And again, the plain sense of this text, I believe, would apply this special protection to all human beings. It would take a leap of eisegesis to read into this text modern notions of only some humans making the cut. So all humans bear God's image, are given special protection, and God's word is clear that this includes those who are socially marginalized. I think every society is very ready to accept that those of us who are of general respect, yeah, we're made in God's image, we're full persons under the law, but throughout Scripture we see that God's great love is given to those who are social outcasts, the ones easy to exclude from society, the ones easy to leave out of the family of human persons. Just a few examples. Leviticus 19, when a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Proverbs 31, speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly, defend the rights of the poor and the needy. That used to be on the front of our Tertial Lamb brochure at Pearl Street, if you remember. And lastly, from James 1, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unstained from the world. These motifs of orphans, widows, foreigners are scattered throughout Scripture. So not only do humans bear God's image, but biblical authors underscore that this includes the outcasts. This includes those who seem to be burdensome, the ones with limited or virtually no utility. So all humans are made in God's image. They have special initial protection. Their blood ought not to be shed, and this includes those marginalized. I think then we're justified making the very modest statement that there is biblical support for the idea that all humans are inherently equal. Now we'll look at a challenge to this in a moment, but first, is there a case to be made for equality in the broader philosophical community? And again, I think so. When we begin to exist at fertilization, human beings have a human nature which remains constant throughout all of their lives. The changes you go through after you're made at fertilization, gaining, losing body parts, gaining, losing abilities, that all of those changes are accidental. That is, they do not change your basic identity as a human being. Because of this, the adult you are today is essentially equal to the pre-born being you were years ago. So if you are inherently valuable today and have natural rights today, you must have had them then. Now, to demonstrate what I mean by human nature, ask yourself a very simple question. Ask, why did I not grow up to be an adult panther? That might seem like a silly question, but the answer is really important. When you were created at fertilization, you did not have a panther nature. You had, at fertilization, a human nature that drove your development from human embryo to human fetus to human newborn to human toddler to the human adult that you are today. Now, embryos from various species, all the way on the left, they may look similar, and abortion advocates make a big deal about that. They say they all look the same at the beginning, therefore there's nothing special about tiny humans. But there is something wildly different. If you look at embryos from various species, our naked eye may not see it when they are young, but a human embryo will never grow up into a fetus pig or to a newborn pig. Because the human fetus will grow according to her human nature. She develops according to that nature, not according to a pig nature. Living beings, then, are not mere collections of parts. We have a nature, in our case, a human nature, which determines what parts we're going to form as we grow older and what characteristics we're going to demonstrate. And this constant nature that you have all through your lives is unique to living beings. Non-living things don't have any sort of binding essence or nature. To illustrate, I have a love story to share with you. A love story of a man and his bike. Now, we have two categories here. We have Wendell and his bike, if I recall being Don Treader. Is that still the case? Yeah, Don Treader, very good. Now, if you have two different categories, Wendell and his bike, Wendell came into existence at fertilization. As Wendell grew, he did not become more of a human. He only became a more mature human. That is, he developed according to his human nature that he had all throughout his life. Is that funny? Good point. Dawn Treader, by comparison, how did the Dawn Treader come into existence? Piece by piece, fashioned by an outside builder, not according to any inherent natural bike nature. There's no essence there. So if the bike Dawn Treader loses its ability to act like a bike. For example, if someone were to dismantle it, convert it into a coffee pot, and put it out in the foyer, would it still be a bike? No, it would be the Dawn Treader coffee pot, maybe, but it would not be a bike anymore. But what if Wendell were to lose his ability to ride a bike? Would he still be Wendell? Yes. Why? Because Wendell has a binding nature and essence he maintains throughout time and change. Non-living things don't have that. Now, here's why all this is important. It might seem a little weird, but here's why it matters. Since there's been no change to Wendell's essential nature through all of his life, all of his changes of growth, development have not changed who he is, it makes sense to say that the Wendell we know and love today is the same, is essentially the same being he was when he was a fetus. So if he has natural rights today, not privileges like the right to vote or drink, but natural rights like the right not to be killed without justification, he must have had them at the beginning. Because there's been, again, no essential change to who he is. Now, furthermore, all humans share this human nature equally. We have it in common. And therefore, it seems reasonable to say that all humans have the same natural rights, whether they be born or pre-born, black or white, etc. Now, for anyone interested in pursuing this further, it's called the substance view of human persons in philosophy, and you can look into it and gather a lot more insight that way. But there are those who do reject this idea, though, that it is being human, which having a human nature, which gives you value and inherent rights, and we'll look at that together in a moment. But understanding now that there is some rich biblical and extra-biblical philosophical support for human equality, let's move on to some challenges to it. Last November, I crossed the Ohio, the Buckeye-Hoosier line to join my father-in-law, Michael Spencer, on the campus of Indiana Wesleyan University. We were invited to participate in a forum titled Life versus Choice to discuss Christian perspectives on elective abortion. And the panel included abortion advocates, who one was an IWU student and two were IWU professors. And in his introductory speech, the student from IWU argued that the image of God is mysterious and cannot be tied to any scientific arguments of when life begins. He then went on to reference abortion advocates' favorite passage from the Bible, which is in Exodus, and argue that that proves the Bible does not value all humans equally, and therefore equality is dismantled and elective abortion is justified. Let's look at these one at a time. First, the image of God. Well, frankly, I admit he's right. The image of God is not a scientific concept. However, the plain sense of the text we just reviewed this morning is that all entities who belong to that category, human being, are made in God's image. And whether or not you are a human being is indeed an inquiry of science. So whereas science can't prove the image of God, it can provide the evidence to determine whether or not you are a human being. And if you are a human being, according to the text we saw, you do bear God's image. But the student, as I said, went on to not just reference the mystery of the image of God, but to use Exodus 21, 22 to 25 as evidence the Bible does not rank preborn life equal to born life. Let's look at the passage together. When men strive together and hurt a woman with child, so that there's a miscarriage and yet no harm follows, the one who hurt her shall be fined according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judge determine. If any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Now, the difference in penalty, this is a Revised Standard Version. The difference in penalty, merely a fine for causing the death of a child in miscarriage, as opposed to eye for eye, tooth for tooth, lex talionis, or the law of retribution, for the mother, it is argued, shows that the preborn is not equal to the born mother. The student went on to say this theme is not unique. Throughout Scripture, the value of human life is variable and its definition is fluid. But there's a problem with his argument in Exodus 21. First of all, even if we were to grant his interpretation of this passage, even if we were to say that were correct, it would not follow a mother may willfully kill her preborn child by elective abortion. At best, this passage may say that a lesser penalty is given for accidentally killing a fetus than for accidentally harming the mother. But this discrepancy in penalty does not necessarily lead to the conclusion that the fetus is less of a person we may kill at will by abortion. But there's even a bigger problem here. You might notice I quoted the RSV. I don't read RSV. But when I was making my notes, I was struggling to find an interpretation, a translation that would support his argument. Why? Because it's a very suspect rendering. One of our earliest hermeneutic lessons is compare translations. When you do that with Exodus 21, you see something very interesting happen. Here's ESV. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined. NIV. Hit a pregnant woman and she gives birth prematurely, but there is no serious injury. And NKJV. So that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows. These seem to imply something else entirely. Premature birth, not miscarriage. Now, the Hebrew word used here for miscarriage or premature birth is yatzah, which almost always refers to the emergence of a living thing. A couple examples using in Scripture from Genesis 1. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And from 1 Kings 8:19. Nevertheless, you shall not build the house, but your son who shall be born to you shall build the house for my name. The same word yatzah is used here for bring forth living creatures who shall be born to you a living child. So it would appear that Exodus 21 most likely means if a man hits a woman who is pregnant and she gives birth prematurely, but the child is not injured, then it's just a fine. But if the child is injured, it is indeed life for life, lex talionis. Now, to that IWU student's credit, when Mike Spencer presented this to rebuttal, he said, thank you, I've not heard that before, and sat back down until the next argument came forward. But what about challenges to the philosophical case for human equality we put forth? Namely, that all humans have the same inherent value because they share a common human nature throughout all of their lives. Now, again, our contention is this, that humans are valuable by virtue of who they are, beings with a human nature. They do not lose throughout their lives, even as they experience change. But some straight out reject this notion, and they say human value is not based on who you are, but what you do or what you look like. We call this generally, or should call it, functionalism. It's the view that humans are not valuable in virtue of the kind of thing they are, but instead of a function they can perform. Now, these functions may be physical, like brain structures or heartbeats or brain stems. They could also be non-physical, like self-awareness or relational experience or having memories, things like that. Notable proponents from academia are UC Boulder professor David Boonin and Princeton professor and animal rights champion Peter Singer. Looking at Singer, in Practical Ethics, his famous book detailing his ethical principles, it's clear that he does not dispute the humanity of preborn babies. He is very honest on this. He admits that fetuses and embryos are humans from the beginning. But he rejects there's any special meaning to that. He says this in his book. He writes, the belief that mere membership of our species, irrespective of other characteristics, makes a great difference to the wrongness of killing a being is a legacy of religious doctrines like ours. Not only would Singer reject the concept of God's image being on all humans, he rejects any idea of there being anything special about humans whatsoever. What does he look to instead? Not what you are, but your characteristics, what you can or cannot do. And we'd like to think that such a dangerous philosophy is only outside the church, but there are those slapping Christian labels on it and peddling it to parishioners. In his writing, The Person of the Bible and the Abortion Debate, Dr. Paul D. Simmons, who received his PhD from the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, writes this. The biblical portrait of person is that of a complex, many-sided creature with God-like abilities and the moral responsibility to make choices. The fetus hardly meets those, again, characteristics. He may choose different functions in Singer. He may say it's not self-awareness, it's having the ability to make rational choices, or it's having social experience. But he's doing the same thing, casting aside the idea that humans are valuable in virtue of who they are, and instead placing our value on our characteristics, what we can or cannot do. Now, this idea easily leads to the stripping of personhood away from preborn babies, because after all, they can't do things that we can do. At the beginning, they don't look like us. But to grasp the danger here, let's leave abortion aside for a moment and return to those sun-baked climes of Jamaica. Did the young woman who left such a stark impression on my mind have inherent rights? Did she have natural rights? Was she a person? Well, I see no biblical justification for saying she was less of a person than me, just because she was different. Was she human? Yes, she belongs to that category, then, of human being that means all of us in that category bear God's image. What about those who believe, though, like the IWU student, that the definition of human value and human life is fluid? Well, then maybe she's a person, maybe she's not. It would depend upon your specific definition. Or how do we reckon with her handicaps? Shouldn't persons be able to talk? Isn't that normally what we do? Well, according to that philosophical case we looked at, the substance view of human persons, handicaps or tragedies may take away your characteristics, but they don't, or maybe they'll prevent you from ever exercising them, but they cannot rob your human nature. I could be in a terrible wreck tomorrow and lose my ability to speak, but that would not change my identity as Seth Dreyer, my humanness. And the same is true for those for whom speech is precluded by handicaps. It does not rob their human nature, and therefore, again, they are essentially equal. They have the same natural rights we do. But the functionalist, though, who says that being human doesn't mean much of anything and value comes from what you can do and not what you are, to be consistent, many of them should look at that young woman in Jamaica and say, yeah, she may be a human, but she's surely not a person because she does not do what we do, and therefore she doesn't have the same rights that we have. She's not equal to us. And that is a chilling thought. And this is why this issue of functionalism is not really an objection to our view of equality. It's a different system of thinking entirely. We say human value is what you are. They say it's what you can or cannot do. And this is not limited to professors on college campuses. Students I meet who tell me we should kill children with Down syndrome because they can't do quote-unquote normal human things and it'll be a drain on society, they are parroting this worldview because they're saying those children may be humans, but that doesn't matter. They can't do what we normally should be able to do, and therefore they're not full persons. Now, our time is limited this morning, but I want to give you just a couple of tips for responding to this idea of functionalism, that humans are valuable by virtue of what they can or cannot do. And first is just a question. When you hear anyone say the fetus is not a person or someone with a handicap is not a person because they're not self-aware or they can't do these certain things, first thing you should do is ask them a question. And that is, why is the capacity for that fill-in-the-blank value-giving? Functionalists like Peter Singer will assert that you have to have certain characteristics to have value or to be a human person. He doesn't justify it. Why that certain characteristic is value-giving. And that's not good enough. He's begging the question. He's assuming what he's trying to prove is true without any evidence. So we should press people. We should say, well, how do you know it's having self-awareness? What about self-awareness really gives us value? How do you know that is the function that gives us value as opposed to having something else? And then after you ask that question, we have to bite our tongues and make them respond, because they made the claim that personhood or rights come from certain abilities like self-awareness. We must press them to tell us why. I think I know one reason that I could guess, and that's that they're prejudiced. They have bigotry. What if I said it's not self-awareness that makes you a person or gives you rights, but it's having white skin or blue eyes? Suddenly that would sound like discrimination, wouldn't it? But how is it any less prejudiced for a self-aware man to say you have to be self-aware to be a person? He's merely choosing something about himself, self-awareness, whereas I may choose white skin color, something about me. Doesn't it seem far more reasonable to say that humans, all humans, regardless of what characteristics they do or do not exhibit, have the same inherent rights? I think that's much more reasonable. Secondly, we can also demonstrate to people with this view the dangers of their position, such as what happens to infants. Most functionalists like Peter Singer, their system of thought places personhood sometime after birth, not at birth. Peter Singer, again, he's the honest one. He writes this in his book. Human babies are not born self-aware or capable of grasping they exist over time. They are not persons. The life of a newborn is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. If you pick a quality like self-awareness and say that gives you value, fetuses are left out, but what about newborns? They aren't born self-aware, like Peter Singer admits, so they would not be persons either. And, well, it's also interesting because not only are newborns left out, but then you have non-human animals like pigs or dogs who are self-aware, who are given the value of, given the label of personhood. It seems very bizarre. We ought to demonstrate this to people, what the logical conclusions are of their worldview. Doesn't it seem, again, more reasonable to say that toddlers and newborns are equal in their rights because they have the same human nature, whereas cats are not equal to them because they have a totally different nature? Again, I would think that is a lot more reasonable. And thirdly, honest functionalists like Peter Singer, he may tell you, he may admit, I don't believe in human equality, because they don't, if they're honest. But most people on the street who may tell you, yeah, you have to have self-awareness to be a person, that's why Terry Schiavo didn't count, or that's why preborn babies don't count, even though they may say that, they still want to believe in human equality, because there's something inside of us, God's law written on our hearts, I think, that makes us want to uphold that. So we should very explicitly demonstrate to anyone with this view how their view necessarily destroys any hope of equality. If humans have value because of an acquired property like self-awareness or rational thoughts, it follows that then because those properties come in varying degrees, our rights must also come in varying degrees, and there is no equality. Lincoln wrote about this years before we had this debate about self-awareness in his private papers in 1854. He writes us this about racism. You say A is white and B is black. It is color then, the lighter having the right to enslave the darker. Take care, because by this rule you're to be slave to the first man you meet with fairer skin than your own. Oh, you don't mean color exactly? You mean the whites are intellectually the superiors of the blacks and therefore have the right to enslave them? Take care again. By this rule, you are to be slave to the first man you meet with an intellect superior to your own. Lincoln knew that things like color, intellect, come on a continuum. And if rights come from color, for example, it's not just being white or black, but everything in between that determines how much value, how many rights you have. And we could say the same thing. Oh, it's self-awareness that makes you a person, that gives you rights. And the one who's not self-aware is not a person. You as a self-aware person, you are a self-aware individual, you are a person. Take care, because by this rule, you are less of a person than the first man you meet who's more self-aware than you are. And even in this room, we vary in our self-awareness. This morning, some of us may be tired. We didn't get a lot of sleep last night, or we're lacking coffee, so we're really sleepy. Others of us may be really alert. And so we vary in our self-awareness. If that is the function that makes us persons, that gives us value, those who have more of it are more of a person, those who have less of it are less of a person, and our rights follow. And therefore, human equality does not exist. As Scott Klusendorf says, it's far more reasonable to argue that although humans differ immensely with respect to talents, accomplishments, degrees of development, they're nonetheless equal because they share a common human nature made in God's image. So when engaged in dialogue with someone who's a functionalist, again, which does not only exist on college campuses, we should ask the first question, why is that function value giving? How did you choose self-awareness? How do you know that gives us value? Show them what happens in their worldview. The infants are disqualified, usually. Non-human animals are elevated, and also that human equality is utterly destroyed. In doing so, we're hoping their moral intuition will be offended, and they'll reject their own position. And the last thing you can do is share an illustration from Francis Beckwith. Francis Beckwith says, when you're talking to someone with this position, ask them this scenario. Say, imagine you're in a terrible car wreck that leaves you comatose for 2 years. You later emerge, but during those 2 years, you lack all of your normal functions to be self-aware. You're not conscious you exist over time. And would it be wrong to kill you during those 2 years of sleep? Now, if someone believes self-awareness gives you value as a person, they ought to say, yeah, it'd be okay to kill you. But many of them say, no, the doctor shouldn't kill you during that coma. And you should ask, why? Because when they say no, it seems that they're rooting value not in self-awareness because you don't have it during those 2 years. It seems they're actually reverting to our position. They're saying, no, it's wrong to kill that thing because that thing is a human being. They're actually reverting to our position that humans by definition have value of who or what they are, regardless of properties gained, lost, or not yet gained. Now, this morning we've been kind of jumping into this topic, taking a brief look at equality and objections to it, having a nice discussion in this comfortable room, and I've been bantering with phrases like human nature and functionalism. And doing this, I think it can be fairly easy for the abortion debate to become almost an academic exercise. But what may be academic for you and for me, as you all, many of you know too well, is utter horror for 2,900 humans today and 2,900 humans tomorrow, to say nothing of their parents, who will be carrying baggage possibly for years. The cost of failing to establish and defend human equality from the biblical and philosophical perspective is not merely a blow to our pride as debaters. It is real human lives. So to remind us all of that cost, what I'm going to do now as we move toward a close is to play a 60-second video that many of you have probably seen before. And so doing, I want to preface that with a couple of things. First, parents, please feel free to avert the gaze of your children, or if you like, take a moment now to actually escort them from the room. You are more than welcome to do that. Or anyone else here, if you would not like to see the video, you may certainly avert your gaze. My goal this morning is not to force anyone to see the video. But secondly, I want to say to you this morning that abortion is really bad news. And if this bad news were all that I had to share this morning, we'd be left in despair. Why? Because each of us, all of us, would stand guilty. Whether we participate in abortion directly ourselves, having an abortion, counseling for an abortion, or whether we have only had indirect involvement, perpetuating abortion by our inactivity or merely living in a country in which it is legal, we all bear some corporate guilt of abortion. But there is good news. You know this, but it is my privilege to remind you this morning that the finished work of Jesus Christ on the cross brings forgiveness and healing for the sin of abortion. God does not merely overlook abortion. His Son died for it. So when we see the victims, as we're going to see briefly, I'm going to show you a video showing the primary victims of abortion. We can and should mourn their deaths, but we should not be overcome by our guilt because our Savior took it away. I'm going to show the video now. Thank you. 2,900 times today. Are these victims humans? Undoubtedly. But are they equal to us? That is the debate we are facing today. Not just are they humans, but are they equal? Now, last fall, I found myself with our team. Actually, it was with Aubrey, Josh, and Jamie. Not in the warm love of the Jamaican infirmary, but on a chilly street outside a boarded-up building in Philadelphia. We were on our way to show a video like just what you saw in Independence Mall next to Liberty Bell. But first, we paused by the now-defunct abortion facility of infamous Kermit Gosnell, the abortionist who was killing babies by having them be born and then using scissors in the back of their skull. And on the grimy front window of the haunted building were stickers with the heading, "I wish this was," and space below where citizens could write in what they wanted the place to be instead of what it had been before. And some wrote truly heartbreaking things like, "I wish this was a place to recover from people taking your children." But I was particularly struck by another where someone had simply written this, "I wish this was a better place." And I was struck because that is what we want. We don't just want an absence of abortion. We want something better. And so we want to know not only what we're fighting against, but also what we're fighting for. We are fighting against the killing, the dismemberment of innocent human beings who are equal to us. But we're also working towards something far better, veritable equality, a long march our civilization has gone through for a long time, working against other injustices and now also against abortion. We're looking for a better America, a better society in which babies no longer are dismembered, parents are no longer left with baggage they have to drag to the cross. But how will we get there? We have to dig in the debate. We have to make awkward conversations happen. And this morning we looked very briefly at the biblical support for the idea that all humans are equal. We talked about how we can see from the plain sense of the scriptures that humans are made in God's image, and we all share the special initial protection. And we can look at people who say that this is a mysterious concept, God's image, and say, maybe we can't tell you, describe to you where it's located in your body. It's not a physical part of you. We can certainly determine whether or not you are a human being. And if you are, you are made in God's image. You share that value as well. You also have the same rights as other beings made in his image. But there are those who reject that idea of being made in God's image. And so we talked about the philosophical case for human equality, that you may be different than you were years ago when you were a preborn child, but all of your change has not changed your identity. You are the same being now as you were then. And tomorrow you may lose abilities, like you may no longer, maybe you'll lose all your memories tomorrow, but that will not change who you are. You are essentially the same being. And therefore, any rights you have today, natural rights, you must have had at the beginning. We also looked at some brief challenges to this, the idea of functionalism, that humans have value based upon not what they are, but certain characteristics they can or cannot exhibit. These are the challenging objections we are facing and the different systems of thought we are trying to dismantle. Now, don't be discouraged. Becoming conversant in these issues does not happen overnight. It takes practice, just being out there and having conversations with people. And twice per year, I have the privilege of seeing students do just that. The students who come on our justice rides, they are not all, many of them are brand new to this, brand new to being an apologist. But these newbies, by the end of the week, have become artful apologists because they interact with the worldview by day and debrief the seasoned defenders by night. So our next justice ride leaves July 12th. Brief commercial, anyone who would like to join us, we're accepting applications soon. But making a better place here in America means not only ending the crime, it means replacing the worldview, making it possible. A better place means not only the absence of injustice, but the presence of justice. We replace the lies with God's truth. We simultaneously seek to end the killing and defend human equality. Because today the debate rages. Are humans valuable because of who they are or what they can or cannot do? How we answer that question will affect preborn children, handicapped men and women, elderly people, and actually every single one of us. Are we created equal? I think we know the answer. Now we just have to get out there and share it. Thank you.
Oh. Well, thank you, Seth. It's always good to have you come back and give us some sort of a course on apologetics, pro-life apologetics training. I think it's easy for us sometimes to forget some of the important arguments or to grow weak in being able to defend the pro-life position. We like to stay current, like to stay sharp on that. So thank you for this morning and, just equipping us in that way. And those arguments were tight, well said, well stated. We are, again, just want to affirm, we are so happy that you've been a part of our church. Some of you who are visitors may not realize that Seth was on staff here for a season. How many years was it? Three years. So we're glad to have sent you out, and it's been a good investment because we're just proud of your work, your ministry, your mind, and especially of your commitment to this. And we are glad that you are on our side very much. Why don't we stand? We'll have the children come in at this time and the musicians.